Well, here we are, Johnny Morgan and Cal Alexander for another episode of the Filthy Lippo. And I'm over the moon because this man has got so many great stories. He's been around the world a zillion times. He looks sharp as a fox. He teaches like a fox. He really does. He's got a very good words of wisdom. It's Tim Barter, everybody. Here he is. How you doing, Tim?
I'm extremely well, Mr. Morgan. How are you? Looking bonny there.
Bonnie, a bit sleepy, eh? That's why I'm on a little bit of a coffee, a bit of a wake-up call. But you know what I mean? It's nice to have you on, mucker.
Well, I've been looking forward to coming on. I'm a fan of the Filthy Lip Out, so looking forward to coming on and seeing you and Kit and having a chat. Hopefully you won't embarrass me too bad.
Nah, what can we embarrass you about, mate? I know Kit's got plenty of stuff to ask you because he's dying to meet you, mate. So, yeah, let's crack on.
Yeah. First of all, there's only one place to start, isn't there? Richard Bland at the British Masters. What a win. The comms were emotional. We could see your fist pumps by the green, your emotion. I was emotional watching it at home, and I don't really know Richard or yourself until now. So what was that like for you last weekend?
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. It really was. As you probably know, I've worked with Richard since the year he came on tour in 2002. So this is our 20th year together. And as soon as I started coaching him, I knew he was an exceptional talent. I'd already coached a couple of tour players and had some success, wins, and Coulthard had played Ryder Cup and stuff like that. So, you know, I knew what it took to be a European Tour champion. And this guy, to me, had all the ingredients, you know, needed some work on his golf swing. Alan Bridgestone and Dibden had done a great job on him and given him a terrific swing, but it just needed a little bit of tidying up here and there. Short game was a sound other than bunker play, which wasn't all that brilliant, but we fixed that pretty quickly. So he looked like, you know, this is a guy that is going to have a lot of success on the tour. And sure enough, in his 15th start at the Irish Open in 2002, he had a filthy lip out, let's call it. The ball went right round the hole and came back at him to win that tournament, and he missed out. So you thought, well, it's only a matter of time, he'll win the following year or whatever. And it just didn't pan out. And the longer it went on, the more it was a case of him having chances and then trying too hard, desperately wanting it too much, getting in his own way, potentially. I mean, he said yesterday when we chatted on another podcast that, you know, he felt he had got in his own way at times and not allowed himself to just play the golf he'd played over the first three rounds in the final round. And it had, I think, 3 second places and three or four thirds, whatever, but just never got over the line. So to get to 48 and having not done it, you kind of think, well, you know, his chance is very probably gone. And if he does get another, it might be his last. So then to go out in that circumstance, and there's quite a lot of stories about what we talked about on the Friday night, the Saturday morning, and so on and so forth, but just incredibly emotional because of how hard he'd worked, you know, okay, to some extent, how hard I'd worked to try and help him become the champion that he should have been. And then for it to happen, particularly at the Belfry, at the British Masters, you know, not just a little tournament somewhere far and wide where I wasn't on site and whatever, to see it and be able to try and interview him at the end of it was fantastic. Yeah, just fantastic.
I was going to ask you, Tim, is this why you've gone so grey, mate, do you reckon?
Teaching Blandy for 20 years will make anybody go grey. I can tell you that for nothing. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Yes, I think I was probably going grey at the start, but it was very quickly gone.
Yeah, I was only going to come back to you. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago. I was over at the KLM and a couple of other events in that season. And I just remember watching Blandy, following Blandy, playing really well, thinking, this is it. It's all happening. You know, this is it. It's going to happen. He's going to win. He's going to win. And he would have been about, what was he, 42, 43 then. And then it didn't happen. I thought, oh. And then years went by and I thought, oh, the boat sailed. I got a feeling. And then I was with you. We were in Cyprus and we went to the range. And you said, I got to go and see Blandy, John. I went, yeah, sweet. And I got to the range. And I mean, this is only, what's that, 8 months ago, if that. And I remember just watching him on the range, just thinking how dialed in he was. You were telling him such critiquey little nuggets, beautiful little golden nuggets. And he was just absolutely, he had it on absolute tap. And you said to me, you went, he's going to win. He's going to win. At some stage, he's definitely going to win. I remember you saying that. And you were so positive. And I kept hold of that. And then when I seen him at the British Masters and he held that putt on 18. I mean, what do you think when that bloody putt went in on 18? Jeez Louise. Holy shit.
I hit my head on a ceiling that was about 12 feet high, I think. Yeah, that time. It was, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. And, you know, we'd had this long conversation. You know, 20 years, I've been trying to persuade him to putt with a bit more authority because he's a dead weight putter. And when he gets nervous, he tends to leave them short. He literally does. I mean, he, you know, like we all do, when you get nervous, you tighten up a little bit, the flow of the stroke can go down slightly. So when you're a deadweight putter and he literally used to dive them in the front edge, then it won't reach the hole. And I used to get so cross with him when we'd talk about it, and I'd say, you know, we've got to have more positivity with these putts. We've got to have the ball running at the hole at more speed. No, I don't want you to batter them 4 feet past and leave yourself a four-footer on per annum your greens coming back. But I am asking for a foot past the hole and not just getting to the front edge. And the Saturday he'd gone out, sorry, Friday, I keep forgetting there's a Saturday finish. The Friday he'd gone out in the last match with Robert McIntyre and hold 37 feet of putts. And that's always a pretty good indication, footage of putts hold. Yeah. And 37 feet is 2 feet a hole. So he'd hold one putt of any distance on the third, the par five, and the rest of them were all tap-ins. Yeah. And he'd hit the ball brilliantly and had lots of chances. And so I thought, you know, he immediately went to the putting green having signed his card, and I thought he's going to want some help here. So I wandered over and he said, I'm all right. I'm okay. And I said, Blandy, how did you think you putted today? And he went, yeah, you know, all right. And Brendan, his caddy, great credit to Brendan. And by the way, great credit to Brendan, because not only is a brilliant caddy, on that day, he did a sparkling job. And caddies don't get enough credit. And he did a brilliant job because, you know, difficult for Blandy at the age of 48, knowing it might be his last chance. He needed some proper positivity and experience behind him. And Brendan provided that in bucket loads. But Brendan chirped up when he said, oh, I putted all right. Brendan chirped up. He couldn't hold himself back. And he just said, Blandy, they barely reached the hole. You know, you need more speed on your putts. You've got to be more aggressive. And Blandy looked straight at me because he knew that's what I'd been saying for 20 years. So he looked at me and he wasn't pleased, to be fair. And he sort of said, I thought my speed was okay. And Brendan went, well, you know, and he then went through his round and he discussed them and sort of said, yeah, the third it was this and the fourth it was that. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, but they just got to the hole. And on per annual greens, that's not good enough because they bobble about quite a bit. Even though you're allowed to tap down spike marks now, they still bobble.
Yeah.
So, you know, we basically said to him, we feel you should putt with more speed. And he didn't say yes. He just wandered off and putted on the other side of the green and ignored us. And I said to Brendan, I said, I know this guy like the back of my hand. And I said, he's absorbed that. He's taken it on board. He's not necessarily going to tell us, okay, I'll go and do it. But he's taking it on board. He will putt with more speed tomorrow. And sure enough, he did. Yeah, and 130 feet of putts, I think it was on the last day, hold a couple of stonkers, obviously, you know, for birdies. And then that last one, you know, just unbelievable. So it was written in the stars. It was meant to be. And I'm just so happy for him that it happened, because I don't think I've ever seen a tour pro practice harder than he does and try harder than he does. And to go through what he went through with very nearly losing his brother, Heath, in 2018, the first 6 months of that year, Blandy was not on the game at all because he was so worried. He lost his card, and we had a big discussion then at the age of 46. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to go to Challenge Tour and get my card back. And you guys know what it's like. You know, Challenge Tour, it's a brilliant breeding ground for players. It's fantastic. Oh, but, you know, the facilities are not like they are on the main tour. The guys on the main tour are really well looked after. Courtesy cars, players' lounges, et cetera, of a very high quality. And you get used to that. And to go back to Challenge Tour and play golf courses that didn't suit Blandy at all, because they're quite often golf club courses that aren't set up for tournaments particularly, and there's not much rough, and the premiums on distance are not on accuracy. So for him to go there at the age of 46 and try and get his card back against all these young guys who are hitting the ball 100 yards past him, you know, was going to be an extremely tough ask psychologically and physically. And we discussed it and said, well, what's the only way that you can compete with these young guys? Because they are going to tank it 30 yards past you off the tee. You've got to be twice as good as them from 120 yards in. And that was the decision we made. And we just worked tirelessly on his wedges, or he worked tirelessly. Just he's hit more wedges than anybody other than DJ, I think, on the planet in the last couple of years. And he has dialed them in. I mean, he now, if I call a random number out, it doesn't matter what it is, he'll get within a yard of it. It might be a little left, a little right, but he literally can hit it whatever yardage you guys say, right, 88 yards, 94 yards, 102, and he will get within a yard. And he is dialed in. So I knew that could keep him competitive. Whether he would win or not is another thing, but I knew it would keep him competitive.
I remember seeing him with his GC quad actually on the rings with you, and he's had that from day one when it first came out from Forsyth, and he's just, you know, he's just dialing in, like you say, wedges all the time. He's always a yard within what he's saying as well. You say, what's that? He's going, like you said, 88, and he's like, might be 87, 80, 89. He's all around that. He just knows it. He's so dialed into him. But what I want to come to, mate, because I mean, lump in my throat. I'm at the Black Horse, a lovely little pub. I'm having a pint of cider on your behalf, mate, because I'm just watching it all unfold, right? So I'm on with my mates, and I'm getting emotional because I'm watching it. And then it comes to the walk-off. He's old the putt against Guido, and he's come towards you. And I thought, right, Tim, I know you've had some amazing interviews and you've got choked up so many times, I'm sure, but this one's got to have a massive lump in your throat. What was that feeling like, giving that interview to your mate, your man, that you've been working with, right at the back of the green? Because I tell you what, it gets me going right now. But honestly, just feeling it and thinking about it, what was that like for you? And did you think you were going to get through this interview?
No, I wasn't sure I was going to get through it. I mean, what happened actually, when he held the putt on the 72nd and then came off to sign his card and wait and see if he'd won or was in a playoff,
yeah,
he came to the interview board then for a sort of preliminary chat to say, you know, do you think 1300 is good enough? And tell me about the putt at the last, whatever. And he stood in front of me and looked at me and we both started to cry.
Oh,
so he said, I don't think we can do this. And I said, no, nor do I. So we gathered ourselves and then did that interview. And again, he broke up at the beginning of it and sort of, because he kind of thought he'd won, I think, because the conditions were poor at the time. The rain was coming down. It was chilly. And then literally 5 minutes later, it cheered up and it allowed the guys to reach the two par fives and made it that little bit easier to get to 13 under. And obviously Guido did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'd got emotional over that one. And I think that probably helped with the final one because we'd already had a decent sized blub.
Yeah.
And then when he came off, I just took several deep breaths and thought, I've got to do my job professionally here. And I've been in that situation a number of times. I mean, Jose Maria and Medina was just a train crash. So, yeah, I just, you know, took a deep breath and I thought his answer to the first question was fantastic. I mean, I say, you know, 478 starts, 20 years and the dreams come true. Describe your emotions, and he said, "Can't." Next question, and of course that makes you laugh.
Yeah.
So I think that helped me because it had he gone into a big emotional blob, I probably would have gone with him, and it would have been car crash television again. But there we are.
Yeah, oh mate, awesome.
It was incredible how you held it together because I like I said, I was emotional at home, and I don't really have the connection to you guys. Just as a golf fan, knowing what goes into it and that journey. Why do you think he has stayed out on tour for so long? Because we see with so many guys, especially as you mentioned, when you slip off of the main tour and go to the challenge tour or you've got to go back to Q school, you know, you're at 46 years of age, you've got a bit of money in the bank. You don't necessarily need to be on the challenge tour or even to be back out there on the European tour at that stage. You might go, I'll chill out a little bit till the Legends tour, whatever. What do you think it is in Richard Bland's makeup and his psyche that has kept him going all these years?
I think two things. I think one, the desire to win, because, you know, whatever they say, and I've interviewed a lot of guys, you know, David Drysdale and people like this, and David Drysdale's brilliant because he's so upfront about it. He says, yeah, if I get to the end of my career without winning, I'll be devastated because I'm a good enough player to win and I've been out here a long time and boy, is he a good enough player. The playoff in Qatar, he proved that 100 times over. Blandy wasn't quite so sort of overt with it. He would sort of say, well, you know, if it's not to be, it's not to be and whatever. But I knew he had a burning desire to win because he should have won half a dozen times, to be fair. He's a good enough player. And he probably knew that he got in his own way. And to get to the end of your career and know that you had the ability to win, you had the work ethic to win, et cetera, but you didn't get over the line because you didn't allow yourself to, would be incredibly frustrating. And he also said to me, what else am I going to do? You know, this is what I do. I play golf. And I can't imagine doing anything else. I love to do it. I love the challenge of it. So I want to go and play seniors golf eventually at 50. So if I lost my card at 46, well, I'm going to kick my heels around for 4 years waiting to get back out. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the drivers behind it, is that he wanted to go and play Champions Tour or potentially European Seniors Tour. So, yeah, those two things, I think. The determination to win, it's what he loves to do, and he needed to prove that he could win, and boy, he did that on Saturday.
Well, mate, it was an amazing thing, and I just want to go back to when you said you were emotional, Tim, with Ollie at Medina. Can you give us what that was like coming up, you know, on the 18th green when he's all like looking up at the stars, you know, thanking Seve?
Yeah, my dog unfortunately passed away a little while ago, but his name was Ollie for a reason. It's that Jose Maria was my favourite player.
Yeah.
And Ollie knew that, and he made him team mascot for that Ryder Cup, which was nice. So my pup was team mascot. So, yeah, Jose Maria is somebody I've just had a great relationship with throughout his whole career. He is the classiest individual. And again, he's been through such adversity to come out and win that second Masters after you know, the injuries he had and the misdiagnosis and, you know, crawling to the bathroom on his hands and knees thinking he might never walk, let alone play golf. And then, you know, so I'd followed his career. I'd become quite close to him and I'd been down and done a big preview. We'd gone down to his hometown, San Sebastian on the northern coast of Spain and done a couple of days with him. And he'd taken me around all the best tapas bars and they are now the best tapas bars in the world. There's no doubt about that.
So nice, he had this great relationship as well, I'm sure, though, Timmy.
Absolutely. Rioja and tapas. So, you know, he was somebody who was really close to my heart. And obviously, Seve, I'd had a relationship with Seve and I was lucky enough to coach him a couple of times. So we had that in common as well. And so I was just very, very close to him. And I didn't see this too. I mean, it's a long story. I'm sorry to bore you, but.
Oh, no, you ain't boring us. You rock on, Timmy.
I have to interview the captains before the final day. So I wait outside the team rooms. And when they arrive, I get a quick word with them about, okay, this is the singles. This is what it's all about. 12 points available, blah, blah, blah. And obviously Seve having passed away and they had Seve on the clothing on the last day. And I knew what that would mean to Ollie. So I waited outside the team room for that interview, knowing it was going to be emotional and knowing he would cry. And I don't go out to make him cry, but I knew whatever I asked him about the Seve logo on the shirts and whatever, he would cry. So I asked him a couple of questions in the preamble. They're 4 points behind, but Poulter had done what he'd done. And there was this sense of, you know, just maybe the miracle's on. And I asked him a couple of questions, which he got through very nicely. And then I had to ask him about Seve. And I sort of said, you know, how emotional, how inspirational it is to have Seve's logo on your shirt. And he just lost it. Absolutely lost it. Couldn't speak and just blubbed like a baby. Just, I've got no, and just walked away. Couldn't answer the question. Whereupon, you know what Ryder Cups are like. We're working 20-hour days at Ryder Cup. We get up at 4 in the morning to go to the course, and you don't generally get to bed till midnight because you're doing prep for the following day and so on and so forth. So I was exhausted, and this is one of my mates blubbing his eyes out, and I lost it, absolutely lost it, and I couldn't stop crying. I literally couldn't stop. And my cameraman's saying to me, Barty, you're going to have to pull yourself together because Davis Love's going to come around the corner in a minute and you've got to interview him. And I was blubbing and couldn't stop. Wanted to stop, but couldn't. Anyway, eventually Davis came. And again, the professionalism, I suppose, kicks in. And I gather myself and interview Davis. So when we get to the end, I know it's going to be horrific. And I'm standing by the 18th green. And obviously, we've won with the Keimer putt. And I've gone and interviewed Keimer. And I've gone and interviewed a couple of other guys about, you know, the trophies coming home and this, that, and the other. And then we're waiting for Molinari and Ollie to come up the last. And I think Tiger had obviously missed the green and Molinari had done what he'd done. And as I was stood literally 10 yards off the green waiting to pounce on the winning captain, which is what I have to do, unbeknown to me, Ollie walked behind me and he tapped me on the shoulder and I turned around and his tears flowing down his face. And the worst thing that happened was I'm standing there, and obviously this is sort of a personal thing to me, but I'm standing there and I cannot pull myself together. I'm crying again, partly because of the exhaustion, I think, but partly because it's Ollie.
Yeah.
And I'm standing there and I somebody taps me on the shoulder again. And I turn around and it's the head of Sky, Jeremy Darroch, right? Not just my boss at Sky Golf, the head of Sky. And I'm crying like a baby. And he knows that I'm about to have to go and interview probably the most important interview of my year, the winning Ryder Cup captain, live in front of the world. And I'm blubbing. So he says, he's a Newcastle lad. He said, you're right, lad. And I went, no, not really. And then from behind him came another one of the Sky bosses, sort of looking at me and going, I'm quite concerned. Are you going to be able to do this? And I said, no, I'll be fine. So I go on the green to interview Ollie, and I thought, I'll keep the Seve question to last. I'll talk about, you know, to win in these circumstances, four behind, Keimer nearly three putting, what, you know. And I can't remember exactly what I asked him, but whatever I asked him, Ollie went, this one is for Seve, and just went first question. And now I'm going, oh, no. So again, I've got tears streaming down my face, but I managed to somehow ask him two or three more questions and we got through it. But yeah, that was with my big bosses standing there watching me, who basically pay my mortgage. It wasn't exactly the way I wanted to be, but there we are.
Mate, that's unbelievable, mate.
That's a legendary interview. That's gone down, you know, Ollie's reaction, everything. So your job is to get the best out of people and to get interesting comments. And by God, you did it on that moment, because that's what everyone wanted at home. We were like, we just sat through this incredible roller coaster of emotions and this amazing final day. And you knew the Seve story. We all knew it. And we wanted that from Ollie. And that's what came. So at the end of the day, you've done your job with cherries on top there. And if you've managed to not blub too much, then that's always a bonus. Yeah. As well.
Well, my first question to Blandy, you can hear my voice crack at the end of the question. It was a it was a much shorter question than I intended. Yeah. I had in my mind to mention the iconic venue, the great champions who've won there and all this. But I literally knew in my mind, I'm going to be crying halfway through this. So I need to get to that end of that question quickly. So, yeah, you can hear me crack. Unfortunately, he then made me laugh and I got through it. But I think otherwise it could have been a blub fest. It would have made quite funny telly, but not great for us.
Did you have roast lamb last night like he did? I just seen the old Twitter stuff. He's got roast lamb with all his mint salt all over the place. I was like, that good lad.
No, I had my favourite, which is sushi. So I had a very nice sushi meal and I finished off the Cloudy Bays. That was all very good.
Oh, very nice too. Very nice too.
Just before we started recording, I sort of jokingly asked if you'd sobered up from the celebrations. And you told us a bit about what were interesting celebrations in this time. Just tell us again so we've got it recorded.
Yeah, well, I was up at obviously at the Belfry, which is 2 hours north of where I live down in Surrey. And my mother moved up to be nearer my sister because I'm on the road so much. She gets more company from my sister and all her kids and stuff. So she lives north of the Belfry by about an hour. And I thought, oh, when I finish at the British Masters, I'll stay overnight in the hotel and I'll go up and see my mum because I haven't seen her for 6 months. So great opportunity. So that was the plan. Of course, Richard then wins and there's a party in Southampton, but I've got to be an hour north of the Belfry the next day. And if I went to the party, I wouldn't be in a fit state to go anywhere. So I stayed in the hotel, but unbeknown to me, just as I got to the hotel, I opened an email that said, oh, this hotel now has allowed the public back in. So unfortunately, because you've been in this COVID bubble, you've got to stay in your room on your own. I wasn't even allowed to go to the bar.
Uh-huh.
So I'm in my room on my own celebrating. I mean, I had literally 150 messages, 150 plus. Like the last time I counted, it was 150. And they were just ping, 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 ping. My phone was going, you know, Twitter was going, WhatsApp was going, messages, emails, whatever. So I just sat there all evening. I ordered 3 large gin and tonics and I sat there and just answered all the messages and said, thank you so much for the support and whatever. And had a good old blub, 2 or 3 things that were sent through with people who knew Blandy and my story and just slurped the gin and tonics. But yeah, I was on my own. So it wasn't as much fun as it could have been.
The reaction has been incredible. I mean, it has resonated far beyond what I imagine yourself or Richard could ever have expected. I mean, Fred Couples was commenting on it. All the American media have picked up on it as well. And the story way more than they would most European Tour events. Pretty much every player that's played on the European Tour, I think, in the last 30, 40 years has probably reached out, put something on Twitter, Instagram, whatever. It has been incredible. Has that been a surprise to you and Richard?
Oh, beyond a surprise. I mean, literally, you know, you knew that because he's a popular guy and because people knew he was capable and he hadn't got over the line and they kind of looked at him and thought, you know, maybe you have got in your own way and you haven't allowed it to happen. And so there was a little bit of sympathy for him, really, because, you know, that ability to go out and bravely attack a golf course when there's a lot of money on the line. And although he's had a decent career, you know, money's still a factor. He still has to pay mortgages and whatever. So, you know, he wasn't in a position. He used to say to me, well, it's not quite as simple as it would be for Rory, who's got 10 million in the bank. If he doesn't win, then so what? But, you know, when I'm standing over a shot tight to water and the consequences of missing it, I lose 50,000 quid. That's significant. Mm-hmm. So I think there was so much love for him on the tour because he is a great character. Lots of banter. People take the mickey out of him. He takes the mickey out of them. And to be out there for 20 years and be good enough to win and not win, you know, is an incredibly unusual situation. There's a couple of other guys that have been through it. Malcolm McKenzie, notably, over 500 tournaments when he won the French Open. And there was a similar situation when he won. You know, people just That's look true. At it and think, wow, to go out there and be at it that long and want it that badly and then eventually produce it at that sort of age. You know, he's the oldest first-time winner in the history of golf, I think. So it just took me 48 years to figure out how to teach him, I suppose. But yeah, the outpouring has been unbelievable. I mean, I've heard from people all around the world. Some people I haven't spoken to for 20 years and players I've not really had a massive relationship with. I mean, Darren Clark's message was hilarious. There was more expletives than it you can possibly imagine. So, yeah, just brilliant messages from all over the place. And, you know, even I've had the New York Times ringing me up and interviewing me and various other newspaper journalists and whatever. And I didn't hit a shot. You know, it's nothing to do with me. I'm just watching the guy do it. So, it has been unbelievable. And I think it's really touched Richard. I think everybody's seen how much people loved and respected him and admire what he did. Because as we've said, you know, at 48, it might have been his last chance. Probably not. He probably would have got one more, maybe two more, but he's not going to go on forever. And to get it done in those circumstances. And, you know, we had this exchange on the Saturday morning, I sent him a text, basically, you know, trying to make him have belief and confidence in himself. And it's something I've done before, but maybe not to this extent. And I sent him all of his stats. And I said, literally, mate, you are golfing them off the course from tee to green. He was number one in fairways hit, number one in strokes gained tee to green. He'd only made one bogey, which was well ahead of everybody else. His greens in regulation, I think he was second. Strokes gained approach, he was second. I mean, he was out golfing them from tee to green. And he won the golf tournament ranked 100th in putting, which is extraordinary. I mean, you don't win golf tournaments.
That doesn't happen, does it?
You know, you miss the cut. If you're 100th in putting, you miss the cut. And he was 29.75 putts and won the golf tournament with 13 under. So I sent him those stats and said, look, from tee to green, you are killing them. If you just putt a little bit more positively, you know, and a few go in, this could be the day. And he said to me in the interview we did when he led, joint led after two rounds, I said, what would it mean to you to win at this stage of your life here at the Belfry? And he said, well, it'd be like all my Christmases coming together. To win at all would be fantastic, but to win the British Masters, which Seve's won and all these great names, at the Belfry with all of its history, in my home country, that would be all my Christmases come together. And I'd put that line in the text and said, if you want all your Christmases coming together, this is not a day for a nice steady 69. You've got to shoot 66 minimum to get out there and do it, because you're playing well enough to do it. So let's do it. And I've never given him a number in 477 starts. I've never said a number on the final day. And he's had several chances. I've never said you need 69, 68, whatever it was. The first time I've mentioned a number and he holds that putt on the last green to shoot 66. And you go, well, if I'd known that, I'd have done it in the second start. You know?
Why wasn't I giving him numbers before?
Exactly. It's been my fault. I've obviously just not done it right. You know?
I was going to say, Tim, I mean, you mentioned coaching Seve. I just want to know what that list is like of coaching. You know, I mean, you've had 20 years with Blandy, but come on, man, dish the dirt. Who have you coached and what little nuggets have you got for the public, man?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, one of the funny stories, and again, you must stop me if I'm going on too long, but
one of the funny stories is... for about an hour, Aaron Corter we do, so you're all right, Tim. Okay, right.
So one of the funny stories is I was, you know, I'll blow my own trumpet a little bit and say I'm a really good coach of club players. I just seem to have a knack of being able to coach club players because I keep it really simple and just try and, you know, nudge them along, and I do it pretty well. But I didn't ever think I was good enough to coach tour players, nor did I want to, because you're all as mad as a box of frogs.
Yeah, that's true.
So I didn't want to coach tour players. And I'd been asked a couple of times after being out on tour and whatever. And I said, no, sorry, I'm not going to coach tour players. I don't want to be woken up at midnight and said, you think if I flatten my backswing, I could do that? I don't want that. And I know what I'm like. I know that I care too much. And if they were missing cuts, I wouldn't sleep and I'd be worried about what I'm doing wrong and this and the other. So I thought, I don't want to coach tour players. No way. And what happened a few times, and it happened particularly with Darren Clark a couple of times.
Yeah.
Pete Cowan coaches, as you know, many of the top players. And Darren, a couple of times, Pete had gone home. Pete generally is there till Thursday night and then goes home. And a couple of times, Darren had really lost the plot, notably at the Volvo Masters one year. I got a message. I walked off the 18th green. I was on course commentating. Walked off the 18th green. Get a message. Go to the range. Didn't even know who it was from. It just goes to the range. Bloke hands me a piece of paper. Go to the range. So I turn up and Darren's on the range and there are golf clubs strewn all over the place where he's losing the plot and throwing things. And he'd gone out in a good position on the third round and played poorly, really quite poorly. And so I turned up and I'd helped him a couple of times already. And he said, look, Pete's gone home. I can't find, you know, anything. I can't hit the thing at all. I've just played horribly. And yet I was playing okay when Pete left. Put me back together. And he had the biggest hump you've ever seen. And I said, Darren, you're in no fit state to work. You're really not. I said, I'll give you a hand. But I said, you're in no fit state to work. And his wife, unfortunately, Heather, who passed away, had just arrived. I'd just seen her. And she'd gone, where is he, Barty? I said, I think he's on the range. I think I've just got the call. So I said, I've just seen Heather arrive. Go and have an evening off. Go and have a nice meal with Heather and calm down. And tomorrow morning, we'll fix it before you go out and play. And he went, no, you're fixing it now. You're fixing it now. I can't go to bed and sleep hitting it this badly. It's not happening. So I said, no. And I think he threw another club anyway. So Chubby Chandler was there and he looked at me and shook his head and thought, you know, he's just not in a fit state to do any work because his head's off. So anyway, I said, no, I'll fix it tomorrow. And I wouldn't give in. And he doesn't pay me, so I can tell him to stick it. You know, I don't have to do what he tells me.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I'm not doing it, Darren. I'm not coaching you in this state of mind because we're not going to achieve anything. And tomorrow when you're calmer, we'll have a chance, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he said, you promise you'll fix it. And I went, yeah, I promise. And I thought, what am I saying? I mean, what am I doing? I said, yeah, I promise I'll fix it. You'll be flushing it when you tee off. And I didn't, as it's going out of my mouth, I'm thinking, you idiot. Anyway, so the next morning we get up, we go out an hour before his tee time or an hour and a half before his tee time. And, you know, he was calmer and he was easy to fix. And he went out in 29 and got himself into the lead of the tournament. And that was another funny story because I was on a buggy. I jumped on the back of this buggy. Headed to the 10th tee, and Billy Foster and Darren were on the buggy ahead of me, and I could hear them chatting. And Darren said, Billy, I'm too excited. He said, you basically call it from now on. You just tell me what to do and I'll do it. So you say hit 3-iron at the left-hand trap. Oh. You say hit, you know, he said, you're in charge. You're in charge. Because he's out in 29. He's flushing it. You know, everything's happening. He's got into the lead and off he goes. So literally, I followed it on the back nine and Billy just controlled him all the way around. And he did exactly what Billy told him and he won the tournament. He shot 63 and he won the tournament. Oh. And I think Coulthard had seen that happen a couple of times. He'd seen me help out other players just because their coach wasn't around. And he liked the way that I coached because it was simple and it wasn't complicated language or, you know, elaborate stuff. So he kept asking me to coach him. And I said, no, don't want to be a tour coach. Not interested. And then I used to be at a golf club called Botley Park down at Southampton. And I was back there the week after a tournament. And my lesson list was there for me in the morning. And in walks Mr. Smith at 9 o'clock. And it's Coulthard. And he'd booked a lesson under a false name so that I would get to coach him.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So he walked in. I went, no. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm Mr. Smith at 9 o'clock. And I went, no, it's not happening. So eventually he said, no, you've got to coach me. He said, I love the way you coach. And I think, you know, we could do great things and this, that, and the other. He was a very fine player already. He didn't really need my help anyway. But I said no again. I said no. And he said, look, just come out and look at my fundamentals. Just check my grip, my ball position, my alignment, whatever, because I'm struggling and I could really do with some help. And you're my mate. Come on, you're my mate. So I said, right, I'll check your fundamentals and that's it. So we went out there anyway. He's aiming 30 yards right. So I've looked out. There's two 150 boards down the range and I've gone, aim at the left-hand 150 and it'd be some middle irons once he'd warmed up. So he's aiming at the right-hand 150. So I said to him, which board are you aiming at? He said, the left-hand 150. I said, oh, okay. And he's aiming at the right-hand one. So I filmed him and showed him. And he's gone, well, how's that happened? And I said, well, you've obviously just crept a yard at a time, you know. And I think he thought he was pushing it and actually was pulling it 20 yards. So that's why he couldn't fix it.
Yeah.
So I agreed, you know, we got him lined up. And I said, look, to start with, because you've been pulling it 20 yards, you're going to pull this 20 yards left. But your instinct will then take over and your golf swing will adapt and your good alignment will work. So we worked on it for an hour or two and it started to come together. So then he said, right, okay. He said, what about my grip? And I said, well, what about your grip? And he's got a four knuckle left-hand grip. And I said, what about your grip? And he said, I've always wanted to change my grip. And I went, oh, for goodness sake. I said, you know, you're a winner already. I think he'd won Qatar by that stage and in Australia as well. So I said, what are you know, your grip's your grip. You're done, you know. And he said, well, how would I change it if I wanted to change it? I said, I'm not showing you. No. I said, your golf swing marries with your grip. The two are things that are associated with each other. If you change your grip, your golf swing won't work. And he said, well, just show me how I do it. And I went, no. And anyway, eventually I did. And I still don't, to this day, don't know why I showed him. But I said, well, if you're going to do it, you do it like this. And I said, when I changed my grip as a kid, it's a very difficult thing to do because it feels uncomfortable. And the first thing you've got to do is make it feel comfortable before you try and hit balls with it. So I said, so I would have a club at the bottom of the stairs, a club in the loo, a club in the bedroom, a club in the kitchen. And every time you pass that club, pick it up, grip it 10 times. And then it will start to feel comfortable because you'll do 1,000 grips a day.
Yeah.
And it will start to feel comfortable. Anyway, a week later, he rings me up and says, done it. And I go, oh, God. So I said, no, your golf swing won't work with that new grip. And he said, well, you're going to have to teach me, aren't you? So he then arrived down at Botley again. And look at this grip, and it's immaculate. He's got a perfect grip. But of course, then we have to do some work on his golf swing just to save him from being 18 handicapped, because he would have been. 2 weeks later, he says, oh, I'm going to go and play. So I said, you're not ready to play, Coulthard. I said, you know, you're not ready to play. He said, oh, I'm going to go and play in Estoril or somewhere. Anyway, he goes and finishes fourth. 2 weeks later, he finishes second. And Chubby rings me up and says, he's not taking no for an answer. You're under contract. That's it. It's done. And that was how I got into teaching tour pros. And before I knew it, I had six guys and I didn't want any of them. So I've gradually managed to get rid of all of them except Blandy, who would not go. So There we go.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Brilliant.
That is amazing.
In your TV life, of course, you were over at Kiowa to sort of switch things up to the PGA Championship a bit. You were over at Kiowa when Rory won 9 years ago. Give us a bit of an insight into that golf course, because all we're hearing at the moment is, you know, it's the longest in history, but you look at the leaderboard from last year, and it was last time, and it was pretty long then, only 200 yards shorter. So for the time, it was a beastly golf course. And aside from Rory winning it, most of the top 10 were guys who would be considered shorter hitters, really. So what do you make of the course and who it's going to suit?
I'm hearing from guys that are over there that I've had a chat with that it's brutally set up. It's really, really difficult. And it's scheduled to blow 15 or 20. So you're going to need to be decent in the wind. It's not that narrow off the tee, but like all Pete Dye courses, you stand on the tee and it doesn't look like there's a fairway, but there is one, but you need to kind of go down the fairway and look back at the tee in order to get a decent appreciation of it. And they're not that tight, but if you miss them, you are in all sorts of mischief. So it's not going to suit anybody who sprays it about. You've got to hit it half reasonably straight, although I say they're not that tight. One of the main skills you're going to need is short game, because there's lots of runoffs and you're going to face some really difficult chips and pitches around the green. So you're going to need a brilliant short game, and you're going to need to be able to play well in wind. And yeah, as you say, that the last time the leaderboard didn't reflect what we expected, because we thought it was a slugger's paradise, and it wasn't. Now, whether that was just an anomaly, I don't know. You've got to imagine it suits a guy who hits it a really long way. But I think, you know, you are going to need to be pretty good all round. You're certainly going to need to be good around the greens, because you're going to miss some in the wind. And if you miss them, then you've got to better get up and down. So I think that possibly outweighs the length. I think it's possible for you to play well there if you're a medium length hitter, as if your short game's really sharp. But if you got one of the long boys with a decent short game that week as well, they'd be hard to beat.
Yeah, I would agree, mate. 7,823 yards long. My goodness, what is it coming to, boy? Jeez Louise. At ground level as well, at sea level, right there, with wind. Holy moly, got to jump out. I'd be chucking a few discs at me back if I was trying to go around that golf course.
Yes, it is. It is brutal. I mean, I think there's six par fours, 480 yards plus.
Yeah.
Well, when I started to play golf, a par five started at 477, and that was it. It was bang on. You know, if there was any hole longer than 477, it was a par five.
Yeah.
And now there's six of the par fours that are over 480. So it is an extraordinarily long course, but you know, it depends on the ground conditions, and I'm not that familiar with what they are at the moment, whether it's firm. If it's firm and running, obviously that allows the shorter boys to get it out over 300, and then they're competitive. But if it's not, then it's going to be brutally long and brutally difficult. And if the wind does blow like they expect it to, you know, the one thing you'd say is the greens, it's past Bantam grass, so the greens will be a bit slower than many of the major championships would be. And the fairways will run a bit slower, because past Bantam isn't a fast running grass.
Yeah.
So yeah, from that point of view, then, you know, Jordan Spieth, I know, has been talked about, obviously, as a potential winner, and he likes Paspalum, and I've talked to him about that in the past. You know, you'd have to think he's in the mix. You've got to think Rory's in the mix, clearly. I mean, again, he's a bit... Rory, I look at and think, well, having not won a major since 14, does he want it too much? You know, is he in a sort of Blandy situation in a different sphere? Is he so desperate to get the next one because he knows probably it'll kick on? Has he got in his own way? Though we know he's got all the bottle in the world. You know, if you want something too badly, it's quite difficult just to relax and go play. And we've seen from his starts in majors in recent times that he hasn't got off to a good start. And maybe that's just because he's nervous, because he thinks, right, here it is. This is my chance to get that major ball rolling again. Yeah. So I think if he gets a good start, Rory could be incredibly dangerous, because clearly he played beautifully at Quail Hollow.
I mean, how difficult is it, though, Tim? Because you've got, like, Tom Watson never won a PGA Championship, so he never got his Grand Slam. Arnold Palmer, exactly the same, never won the PGA Championship to get his Grand Slam. And then you got Jordan Spieth, you just mentioned, who's going to be one of the favourites coming into it with a mustard short game. Mustard short game. And, it, you know, how much does that play on their minds as top players like they are?
I think it does play on their minds a lot. I think Rory particularly has admitted that, basically the first couple of times he had a chance at the Masters to complete the career Grand Slam. I mean, only six guys have done it, or five guys have done it. He would be the sixth. And that takes everybody from a great player to a legend player. You know, I know Mickelson told me that even though he's won three majors and finished second in the other one six times, so if you could argue someone hasn't got the Grand Slam, he's come closer than anybody else. And he said he would feel completely differently about his whole career if he could complete the Grand Slam. Completely differently. So that's a big pressure. Having said that, Spieth is so mentally strong, it's scary. I mean, for him to do what he did at the Open, after all that splashing around and making whatever he made, you know, to then bounce back and make those birdies coming in, he shows you he's got mental strength like very, very few players. So I actually think he could convert it perhaps more easily than Phil and Rory in that sense.
Yeah.
Because he does have an incredible mental strength and an ability just to put shots behind him and move on, which is, you know, not everybody has.
And what he's been through in the last year, 18 months prior to that form coming back, you know, none of those other big names, they've been out of form a little bit. Obviously, Rory was on a bit of a drought prior to the win at Quail Hollow, but never to the extent to where Jordan slipped to prior to his little comeback. Their off wasn't as off. So you do feel he's a bit more mentally rounded and has that greater perspective of how bad things get, that he wouldn't be as affected in that situation. Whether that plays out and shows to be the case or not, we'll see. But I have to agree exactly what you've said on Rory putting too much pressure on himself in the majors. I think that is an element because he does want it so badly. It's often said he doesn't want it enough and he doesn't care enough and there's other things and nothing could be farther from the truth. And I think that's evident in, like you say, those slow starts in the majors. If you were looking at an outsider this week, are there any names that wouldn't be at the top of the bookies or the top of the world rankings that you think, oh, he could make a sneaky little run?
To be honest, because of the Blandy situation, I've been wrapped up in the last few days and I haven't looked at this as closely as I normally would have done. But people that come to mind and I know have been mentioned in tweets I've looked at and whatever are people like Tommy Fleetwood, not that he's an outsider, but Tommy Fleetwood and Shane Lowry, both people who are very, very good links golf players. And although this isn't typical links because you kind of have to play the ball a bit more through the air at this course, it's got a lot of links characteristics about it with slopey lies and with wind and et cetera, et cetera, chips around the green. And Lowry, as we know, is as good as anybody around the greens and Tommy's not far behind him. Yeah. So those are a couple of people that, you know, I would love to, because they're both brilliant guys who I'm pretty close to. So I'd love to see either of those do it. And just off the top of my head, yeah, they're, you know, they're probably 30 to 1 and 40, 50, 60 to 1, whatever it might be. And both in decent form.
Get them a bit longer than that, actually.
Okay, well, then if you can, then I would suggest they would be worth a flutter, because both are infinitely capable. I mean, Shoffley, I'm sure, is a short price, but he's someone who's going to win a major before long. So Shoffley is somebody I would be looking at outside of the obvious ones, you know, the Bryces, the Rorys, the Jordans. Shoffley is somebody who perhaps is a slightly higher price than he should be per number four in the world or whatever he is. So he would be somebody I'd look at, yeah.
Yeah. John, yesterday we were talking about whether the PGA should be an international major. And take it
You're going down this road,
aren't you? John and I got into a little bit. We didn't mean to, but John just mentioned it as something we could talk about today. And we ended up having a debate about it for 5 or 10 minutes about whether it should be an international major, whether that's never going to happen. So do you add a fifth major? So there is one that can travel around the world. John was very against that. What are your thoughts, Tim? Do you think we need an international major, or are we all okay how we are now?
You do not have a fifth major under any circumstances. History is history. History is history. You knacker the whole thing up if you have a fifth major. You know, people will argue, well, there didn't used to be four majors until so-and-so, whatever. But I just think, no, it's been too long now. We've got four majors. We've got Jack Nicklaus's record of 18. If you start having 5 and 6 and somebody beats him, are they the greatest of all time? You can't quantify it. It's impossible. Yes, I think it should be international. I think the fact that 3 or 4 majors are in America is regrettable. I think there should be one allowed to travel, and the PGA Championship is perhaps the obvious one, in that the Masters is on the same venue every time, and the US Open is the US Open. You know, and the PGA of America obviously is an American organization, and they could argue that, you know, it should stay in America and probably got a decent argument for that. But, you know, professionals, PGA professionals are all around the world. Why not take it on its travels? I think that'd be a terrific idea. Take it to the Far East, take it to Australia, take it, you know, potentially over here, although we've got the Open already, so that would be greedy. But yeah, take it somewhere, I think, would be a terrific idea. I don't think it'll ever happen, not in my lifetime anyway. I'm getting old now. But I would love to see it happen. I think it would be a great thing. I think the fact that the Far East and you know, even Dubai and countries like this that do so much for golf will never have a major, you know, it's a shame. India should have, you know, potentially have a major, because that what would it do for that culture, you know, to have a major and the amount of people they've got would be amazing. It'd be like the Olympics arriving. So it would be terrific. I just don't think it'll ever happen, but I certainly wouldn't add a fifth major, you know, much as the Players is a fantastic championship and that would be the one that's nominated. for me, history is history and leave it alone. Otherwise, Jack's record and Tiger's record are put at risk when they shouldn't be.
To play devil's
advocate. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Tim.
Play devil's advocate. As you say, the four majors.
You ain't winning.
We've made them the four majors. There was a period in time way back in the day when the Western Open was, I believe, considered to be a major, and now it's not. You're right in saying it would be great that there should be an international major. That would be a massive positive for the game. I also believe you're right that the US PGA Championship is not the event that would do that, and we're not going to see that happen. So then you're down to sort of weighing up whether it's more important to have an international major or it's more important just to keep the four that we see as majors. Now, I think I could make a reasonable argument for the fact that it would be more important for the future of the game going forwards, and that is of greater concern to me than the history of the sport, perhaps, to change the status quo as it is and to add that fifth major to be able to take it around the world and to take golf to markets, like you say, like India, to get a major at somewhere like a Royal Melbourne in Australia, to move it to South America, to South Africa, all of these great destinations that have massive golf markets currently or huge potential for them. The gains of taking majors there, for me, would outweigh any negatives of perhaps messing a little bit with the history and the status quo of four majors as they are now.
It's a good argument, but you ain't going to win it with me, I'm afraid. I would do that. I would do all the things you said with the Olympics. Because the Olympics is a massive vehicle. So take the Olympics to South Africa, take the Olympics to the Far East and let them have their boost. And apparently the Olympics does way more than a major ever could in terms of awareness of golf and so on and so forth. So therefore, do it with the Olympics and don't mess with our history. Thanks very much. Move on.
It's a fair point. And also we could do more with the WGCs because obviously we've got this Premier Golf League, Super Golf League rearing its head. And for me, the two big positives of that, and it's negative overall for me, I wouldn't like to see it really, but the two big positives are that it is truly international and there will be tournaments all around the world and that those tournaments would attract the top 50, 60 guys in theory. So you're getting major championship strength fields but dotted all around the world regularly throughout the year. And that is what the WGCs should be doing now. It's what they were designed to do. So if we're really serious about keeping the status quo, batting back this Premier Golf League, the way to do it isn't with this 40 million player impact initiative, whatever that is. It's by actually using the WGCs for what they were originally meant to be. And that is taking the best players in the world, all around the world, in these high-level events that just aren't quite the majors, so we keep our status quo with that.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. And that hasn't happened enough so far. And, you know, obviously I'm not familiar with all the things that go on in the background in terms of sponsorship and stuff like that. And obviously that's massive. So that can only be the reason, I think, that they haven't travelled more than they perhaps have done. And hopefully that can be resolved in the future because it would be terrific. You know, it's done in Grand Prix and it works well for them. So let's try and spread the joy a little bit more. So I completely agree with that.
I'm glad I get you to agree with something, Tim.
I'm not normally argumentative, but I'm an old fuddy-duddy who believes in his history. And Jack and Tiger, for me, should be allowed to have a level playing field for their incredible careers. So
totally agree.
It wouldn't be a level playing field. I didn't answer your question, Johnny, about the coaching very much, did I? I've waxed on about Coulthard and his silliness, but I was lucky enough to coach Seve a couple of times, which was just an extraordinary honour because he was my hero along with Jack Nicklaus when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And one particular story that I love to tell and people like to hear, I think, is I coached him. Basically, he was being coached by Mac O'Grady, fine coach, and he was struggling, Seve, 1995. He was starting to struggle with his game really quite badly and Mac was helping him and helping him to play a bit better. And it was the Spanish Open at Club de Campo in Madrid. And Seve was desperate to play well because Olazabal was coming through as the new king of Spanish golf. And he didn't want that. As much as he loved Ollie, he wanted to retain his crown.
Yeah.
And so he invited Mac O'Grady to come to the Spanish Open to coach him and help him because he was struggling. And he hadn't seen Mac in a while because Mac's in America and he's in Europe. And Mac said, yeah, great. Send me a first-class plane ticket and off I come. I'll be over. And Seve said, no, you'll travel in the back of the bus like everybody else. And Mac said, not coming. And he didn't come because Seve wouldn't send him a first-class plane ticket and Mac wouldn't come unless he did. So I get to the Spanish Open and I'm walking around the course on the practice day, the Wednesday. And I'm walking down the 10th, little dogleg right, par four down the 10th at Club de Campo. And I look down to the 11th tee and Ken Brown is on the tee, good mate of mine and my fellow on-course commentator that week for Sky. And he's trying to help Seve with his swing, which is ridiculous because Kenny's a brilliant short game coach, particularly putting, but not much of a long game coach, to be fair. And he'd acknowledge the same thing. And he saw me and went, oh my God, there's a proper coach. Let's get him involved. <Come here. laughs> So I'd helped Seve once before. So I had that relationship with him and he kind of, you know, we'd had a little bit of success when I'd helped him. So he called me down and I went down and had a look and Seve said, oh, I'm hitting it sideways. It's just not happy. And he got his brothers with him and his brothers were coaching him. So it was quite a difficult scenario. And eventually he sort of said, you know, I said, what's he doing? He said, it's setting off left and going further left. And, you know, he was a great sort of believer in John Jacobs' teachings and theories and whatever. And John Jacobs put it very simply that if the ball sets off left, you're swinging to the left. And if it then turns left, you've got the club face closed. Now, John Jacobs knew because he was a good friend of mine and John Jacobs knew perfectly well that that wasn't always the case. Very rarely you can actually swing to the right with a club face that's double or triple shut and the ball will still set off left. Yeah. John knew that, but he didn't put it in his books because it was such a rare thing to happen that it would confuse people. If you say, well, it could happen this way, or it could happen that way, they go, well, which one am I? Whereas 99.9 times out of 100, you would be swinging left with the club face closed to make it pull draw. So he was hitting this shot and I looked at it and thought, actually, he's the rare occasion. He's swinging to the right. You know, she's putting it in simple language. He's swinging to the right and the club face is so shut, the ball's setting off left with hook. So he said to me, right, we looked at it on the course and I explained this and he went, no, that's not possible. He said, no, I'm swinging left because the ball's setting off left. And I went, well, you're not. So he said, okay, well, come to the range and we'll discuss it after I've finished, you see. So I then have to go to my TV boss and say, can I have a couple of hours off because I need to go and have a look at someone. And he said, no, he said, you're supposed to interview Monty afternoon or whatever, somebody. So I said, well, I could really do with a couple of hours off to go to the range. And he said, why? And I said, because somebody wants my help and I'd like to give it. And he said, well, tell me who and you can do it. And I said, no, I can't tell you who. And eventually he said, well, you're not doing it then unless you tell me who. And I said, okay, it's Seve. And he went, oh, great, you're going to coach Seve. Right, cameras on it. We're going to have the start of our program will be Tim Barters coaching Seve on the range in the Spanish Open. This is fantastic. And I've gone, no, that's exactly what I didn't want you to know, because Seve's head will come off if you turn up with a TV camera. I said, just please have some respect and stay away and let's get this done. And he said, oh, no, I'll stay away. And I said, I don't trust you. So he said, what about if I do it on a long lens? He said, if I have a camera at the other end of the range, you won't even know we're there. And I said, look, I don't want you anywhere near it. I said, I'm going to go and do it. And I said, I probably won't be able to help him because, you know, I'm not a great coach and this, that, whatever. So I said, so I don't really want it on telly. And, you know, goes out and plays horribly. It just makes me look even worse than I already feel. So I went out to help Seve, and sure enough, the long-range camera is there. I've plopped it in the distance. And after about 5 minutes, in comes the cameraman. There's Tim, there's Seve, isn't it great? And I'm going, oh, no. And Seve says, with that horrible stare he could give you, he said, I see you brought your friends. So I said, Seve, honestly, I begged them not to come, and I'm going to get rid of them straight away. So I just banished them away, and we carried on working. And so he said, you're going to have to convince me that I'm swinging to the right and the club face is double shut because it doesn't make sense to me. So he was using, a Callaway Big Bertha driver at the time. He had a massive, great head cover because it was a big-headed thing. And so I put the head cover literally just outside the golf ball and tilted it slightly so only an inside path could hit it. Yeah. And I said, right, hit me some drivers. So he stands up and he said, you know, I'm going to hit that head cover. And I said, well, I don't think you are, but we'll see. Because if he swings from out to in, he'll hit the head cover. And if he swings the way I think he is, he's not going to hit it. So the first shot, he flushes it straight down the middle with this driver. And he said, you've cured me. He said, because you've put an obstacle in the way of my left swing. And now I can only swing from the right to the right. So you've cured me. Brilliant. He said, by accident, you don't know what you're talking about, but it's worked. So I said, no, do another one. So he hit two or three. And eventually, after about three shots, one set off 20 yards left with hook. And the head cover's just sitting there uninterrupted. So I had a glib look on my face and sort of smugly went, there you go. And he's gone, that's not possible. And I said, well, it is possible because you're swinging too far to the right and the club face is double shut. Mm-hmm. So his brothers were standing behind, or one of them, and shaking his head because he'd been telling him you're swinging from out to in. And obviously it's difficult because it was a misdiagnosis, whatever. But it was such a rare thing. It was, you know, an understandable mistake to make, but I felt it was this anyway. So he hit a few more shots and we talked about, okay, well, you think you're swinging left, so you're trying to swing to the right, and by swinging to the right, you're making it even worse. So we worked on it for an hour or so and it got a bit better. And he went and played the tournament and played a bit better. He didn't play fantastic in terms of tee to green. He played better. He didn't hit the pull draw as much as he was hitting it. He hit one or two and he wins the tournament. So he comes to me after winning the tournament and says, I owe you a great debt. He said, you know, you helped me and you made me understand and I owe you a great debt. And I mischievously said, yeah, but you're not going to pay it, are you? Because, you know. Yeah. And he said, you don't need money, Tim. You don't need money. I said, don't I? Don't I? I don't need money. Right. Okay. So I said, I'll tell you what I'll do with you. I said, if you really want to repay the debt. And he said, I do. I owe you a favor. I said, okay, I want an hour around the chipping green with you. I want to pick your brains for an hour around the chipping green and help my coaching, because to talk to the great Sevi about short game. And he said, right, let's do it. So the next time he came to Wentworth, we spent an hour around the short game area and I literally just battered him with questions and learned so much. It was scary. So that was a great occasion. And one of the things I was doing at the time, I was coaching England youngsters, both boys and girls. And I said to him, look, we give these youngsters, all they want to do is bash balls and hit 300 yards. And I try and get them to work on their short game because it's important to them to be a rounded player. And I said, we struggle to get their interest. They're not, you know, so what we do is we give them little tests and we make them competitive against each other. And I said, we've got 10 tests that we do, chipping test, putting test, bunker test, whatever, pitching. I said, would you do the tests for me so I can give them the benchmark of the great Seriano Ballesteros? I said, it'll take you about 10 minutes to do the test. And I said, you know, you'll cruise them, you'll make them look easy, but can you just do it? Because I'm not somebody who could go back and lie about it and say Sevi got 10 out of 10 or whatever if you didn't physically do it. So he said, okay, right, let's do it. And so we started going through these tests. Anyway, one of the tests was putting a bag towel on the edge of the green and chipping from about, I think we did it from 7 to 10 yards away and landing the ball on the towel and basically saying to these youngsters, look, okay, the first stage of decent chipping is planning the chip and deciding where you want to land it, what sort of shot you're going to play, a running shot, a spinning shot, what are you going to do? And the second stage is to strike the ball properly. And the third stage is where this towel comes in, which is the feel to know how far a swing you need at what speed to land it where you want to land it. If you don't land it where you want to land it, you ain't got to chip very well. So we used to make them aim at this towel and we give them 20 balls and say, how many out of 20 can you land on the towel? And, you know, it got quite competitive. The kids were ringing me up and going, I've got 14, you know, fantastic, whatever it was. And these were all scratch players or young, you know, aspiring professionals. So I asked Sevi to do it anyway. And he went, well, it's too easy. And I said, I know it's too easy, but just do it for me. So he started off and he chipped the first half a dozen. And he said, what club? I said, any club you like. So he chose a club. He's landing it on this towel and he's doing it so easy. Then he starts looking at me and going, and landing it on the towel. Then he looks at me and does it with one hand. So right hand only, landing it on the towel. I went, oh, you're very clever. So he's done 20. He's done 20 out of 20. And I said, okay, that's amazing and great. And he said, well, it's too big a target. A typist bag towel. He said to me, he said, let's make this interesting. I'll spell the word typist. So I'm going to basically hit balls and land it on the letters. Oh, and I've gone. I thought, God, you cocky sausage. I mean, you know, you can't do that. It's impossible. I mean, this is 7 yards away, and these letters are this big. You know, it's not possible. So I said, go on then, clever clogs, let's have a look at it, sort of thing. And he took 9 balls to hit 8 letters. He landed it on every letter other than one. And I am literally, still the most amazing thing I think I've ever seen with a golf club.
Yeah.
It was just bonkers. And I'm looking, and my face must have reflected the fact that I thought I was witnessing a miracle, basically. And I've got my jaw down here. And he said, what's that face for? And I said, Sevi, this is incredible control to land it on the letters. And he went, well, I know if I swing the club that far, it's going to go that far. And I know if I point the club face at the capital T, it'll land on the capital T. Point the club face at the capital T. And he's gone, yeah, that's all I've got to do. And it's now land on it. You know, and it was that much control. That's why he chipped in 3 times around. Still the most incredible thing I think I've ever seen. And we'll probably never see anything as incredible as that again. It was just the most remarkable demonstration of control I've ever seen. And I've seen him do some ridiculous things. I mean, I've seen him beat people out of bunkers with a 4-iron against their lob wedge and whatever. I mean, he was an absolute wizard and he could do stuff that nobody else could do. But yeah, that remains the most remarkable thing I think I've seen.
That's an amazing story, Tim. That's an amazing story, man. I was going to ask you, when you started at Sky, man, when it went from like coaching like the likes of you know, two blogs like myself when we were coming up through, you know, to then, you know, getting the gig with a big mic in your hand. When did it all happen for you, buddy, coming off of that?
1993. So I'm in my 29th year.
Yeah.
Basically came about because I was coaching and I'd met Ewan Murray and he was commentating for Eurosport over in Paris at the time. They had the rights to the European Tour Golf and he used to do it on his own in an underground dungeon in a building called TF1 in Paris. And so we got really friendly and he said to me at one stage, he said, why don't you come over and be a guest in a commentary? And, you know, I can ask you a few questions about technique and we can talk about swings and stuff like that. So I did that. And then he left there to go to, he actually left there to go to a place called Screen Sport in London and then on to Sky. And when Sky started, they said they wanted three people to be commentators. They wanted a player, a coach, and a lead commentator. Well, Ewan was the lead commentator, so he was in the commentary box. Ken Brown was chosen as the on-course commentator, ex-player. And I was lucky enough to get the gig as the coach-type on-course commentator. So started, 29 years ago, 1993. And Ken Brown and I remember sitting down and having a chat. Ken's a great, great guy. And we've had some brilliant times. And he said, how long do you think we can make this last? And I said, well, me, 5 minutes, because I've got no right to be here. I'm just a club pro from Southampton. I mean, what's this about? I said, you, Ryder Cup player, multiple winner in America, et cetera, whatever. You've got every right to be here, and so has Ewan, because he's proved to be a wonderful broadcaster. So I said, but I'll be gone in 30 seconds. They'll figure out, what have we done here, you know? Anyway, we managed to stumble our way through it. And after a couple of years, we're saying, do you think we can get 5 years out of this? Because it would be terrific if we can. And of course, 29 years later, I'm still getting away with it.
How good is that? You do these masterclasses with Sky. Who's been the most impressive for you? I know if Seve was on there, that would have been the proper masterclass of anything. But the ones that you've been able to work with and do those masterclasses with Sky, which one's been the most impressive for you?
Oh, I tell you what, I didn't expect that question.
Yeah, sorry, man. But Tim, you've been everywhere, mate.
Yeah, I mean, they're all impressive in their own way. I mean, Rory was very impressive because I remember Rory, we did it at the Irish Open. And he literally arrived. He was such a busy man because everyone wanted a piece of him at the Irish Open. And we were supposed to do something at like 10 to 1, and he was teeing off in the Pro-Am at 1 o'clock. And in the end, he arrived at like 6 minutes to 1, having not hit a golf shot, and basically said, sorry, Barty, everybody's been grabbing me and whatever. And I'm sorry, I haven't even hit a shot. And I said, okay, well, we'll have a chat. We'll hit one or two and, you know, just use a wedge or whatever. He said, no. And he ended up hitting medium irons or whatever and just flushing it without even talk about a Rolls Royce doesn't take long to warm up. So that was pretty darn impressive. Yeah, the Roars unwarmed up flushing it was good to see, yeah.
Awesome, Tim.
Who's been the most unexpectedly entertaining person to interview, or perhaps their public persona might make them an unexpectedly entertaining interview?
Oh, good question, Kit. Good question.
Interesting. I suppose, actually, just because he's fresh in my mind, because I know he was on our podcast yesterday, I didn't talk to him, but he did the second half of the Sky podcast, David Lynn.
Yeah.
I mean,
we know Linny as a great character, but the public at home would just see this journeyman professional and blah, blah. And he's just fantastic. I mean, we did a piece. He came to me with the idea, actually, because we used to do in the bag features where we'd look at players' clubs and this, that, and the other. And he came to me and said, Barty, I've got a bit of an idea for In the Bag. He said, do you fancy doing a humorous one? I said, absolutely, flaming lootly, let's do it. And one of the things I remember, you know, we talk about the players having their card. Well, their card is their license to play on tour and blah, blah, blah. So we talk a lot about you losing your card, getting your card. And so I remember I said to him, right, you know, I'm with David Lynn. We're going to have a look through his golf bag, some interesting stuff in here. I'm sure, David, you know, just take us through it. Open that big side pocket up, show us what's in there. And so he dives in there and he pulls out this massive piece of card and says, here's my card. Like, I've got that. So, and then we started talking and we teed it up a little bit in advance. And I remember saying to him, you know, you have to shape the ball both ways. You know, you have to fade the ball. You have to draw the ball. You know, have you got that hard draw off the right when the flag's in the back left? Have you got that hard draw? And he reaches around the back of his golf bag and pulls out a physical draw. Wooden drawer. He says, here's my hard drawer. He said, no, it's a great asset to me. I've always got this in my bag, the hard drawer. And he just had bunches of these things teed up. And it was just terrific fun. Yeah, he was all his instigation. I was the straight man and he just took it away. But he was terrific. So yeah, he was an unexpectedly, you know, humorous and great interview, certainly for people at home who wouldn't perhaps know him and certainly wouldn't know he has that sort of personality. And follow him on Twitter because he's hilarious.
Yeah.
And if people want to come and see you, Tim, where do they come and find you, my friend?
They don't. In terms of coaching, unfortunately, I had to pack it up. I had to stop coaching a little while ago because I got so busy with the TV work. And sadly, I've had a couple of really close people to me pass away suddenly. My best mate last year dropped dead at 62, and I'm now 61. And it's just made me think. My brother-in-law died at 59 of prostate cancer and whatever. And I just got to a point where I thought, hang on a minute, I'm working on tour 25 weeks a year. And when I come home, I'm teaching day and night. And I wasn't having any life. And I got to the point, I thought, well, I can't give up the TV work because it's too lucrative, to be fair. And much as I love coaching, and it's what I love to do, and I'll go back to it once the TV thing dries up, I had to say, I can't work every day. I've just got to start having a bit of a life and you know, enjoying my dogs and my wife and taking them on trips away occasionally and stuff when COVID allows. And so I had to say, you know, I'm going to have to stop teaching. And it wasn't fair to say I'll only teach a certain number of people. I thought I'll basically stop. And I now I coach a couple of dozen friends, and Blandy I literally couldn't get rid of. He wouldn't go. So that carries on. But unfortunately, I've literally been not inundated, but I've had a number of requests for coaching since the Blandy story came up. People were saying, would you help me? Would you help my son? And I've had to go back and say, look, I just didn't, because I want to have a life outside of golf as well as enjoy what I do.
I was going to say, fair enough. You fixed Darren Clarke and Seve, and I was about to put in a request, to be fair, like that.
There you go. You're lucky not to get it, because, you know, as I say, it's all smoke and mirrors, I'm afraid. I don't think there's any magic.
I don't believe that for a second. I don't believe that.
It's the last question from me, Tim. I was just going to ask you just a quickie, mate. Who's the best swing you've ever witnessed or been there to see and you've seen on TV, period?
Tiger, when he won the Open at St Andrews, easy, not even close. Technical perfection. I mean, literally technical perfection in the way that I like to see a golf club swung. And obviously, it's not for everybody because you're not that athletic, but Butch and I once had an opportunity. Well, he was kind enough to take me through that video, and he showed me the film he shot personally of Tiger that week. And we went through it and literally couldn't find anything, even minute, that you would look at and go, that needs a tweak or could do with a tweak or it isn't perfection. It was the way I like to see a golf club swung, absolute perfection. Yeah. You know, and there's lots of guys that I admire. I mean, Louis Oosthuizen has got a wonderful golf swing that I love. Adam Scott, when he's in full flight, is a joy to watch. Rory, again. So there's lots and lots of great swingers, but no one, I don't think, from a personal perspective, will ever swing it as well as Tiger did that week. It was just extraordinary.
Yeah, I'm with you, mate.
Absolutely. Just one final question for me as well before we let you go, Tim. I mean, listening to you has been an absolute treat. You've know so many people. You've coached guys that were your heroes. You've interviewed guys that were your heroes. I just wonder, when you were back in your early career thinking, oh, I don't want to go anywhere near the tour. I don't want to be coaching those crazy guys. I'm happy as a teaching club members. To look at what you've achieved now, who you've got to know, who you've coached, the emotions that's brought you. What do you think about the turns that your career has taken along the way and how you've got to this point?
I'm going to write a book, I reckon.
Yeah.
I've just been incredibly lucky. I mean, to get that opportunity in the first place when I didn't justify it. There's no way I should have been commentating on course at a European Tour event. I mean, I'd got my card in 1979, before you guys were born, probably. I'd got my card in 1979, but failed miserably. I mean, literally didn't have the game to play on tour. And it was essentially that, because I'm a perfectionist and I wanted to be successful and earn a nice living and live a nice lifestyle. I then thought, well, if you're not going to be a player, you're going to have to be the best club pro in the country. So I was lucky enough to work for a guy called Roger Mace as an assistant at the Downshire Golf Club in Bracknell. And he was a brilliant club pro and a particularly good merchandiser. He knew how to run a golf shop and make serious money doing it. So he taught me that. I was lucky enough to work under a guy called Ray, who was a brilliant club repairer. So he taught me that. Mm-hmm. I'd obviously got a good enough golf game in that I'd managed to qualify for the tour to be a club pro and a reasonably successful local area club pro and win a few tournaments and stuff like that. That was nice. The one weakness I had was coaching, because Roger wasn't, you know, a great coach. It wasn't what his forte was. He concentrated on the merchandising. So I thought, well, if you're going to be a really good club pro, you've got to learn how to coach and be a good coach. And I sort of set about it. I saved up some money, and I wrote to all the best teachers in the world and asked them if I could come and watch them teach. So I went over to America and watched Bob Toski and Jim Flick, and I went and saw Ledbetter, Jimmy Ballard, I think I saw at one stage. And in Britain, I saw John Sterling, John Garner, obviously John Jacobs. And I just went and sat and listened to them coach and learned a tremendous amount and formulated an opinion. Right, I like that. I don't like that. Boom, boom, boom. And that's the way I could have came up with my ideas. So, yeah, that was basically how I became a great, not a great coach. Oh, blimey, that was a slip. A good coach. And having become a good coach, the opportunity presented itself to do TV. So I was just incredibly lucky. And I suppose the one thing I would say is once I got that break, I thought, right, you are going to work your doodahs off to try and keep this happening. And I'm blessed with that as a natural thing. I've got a work ethic. And John probably knows a little bit about this, but I do work very, very hard at what I do because I'm not very clever and I'm not very talented in most respects. So I have to work really hard in order to be able to achieve something. So I still do hours and hours and hours of preparation to try and make sure that I don't ask the same player the same question twice, even in a year. You know, try and vary it, try and find new things to talk about, look at their social medias, whatever. So I've got that, you know, sort of work ethic that allows me to have got away with it for 29 years, which is what I've done.
Well, I'll say it now, Tim, you are a great coach, buddy. You are a great coach, and that's proof in the pudding, mate. That's proof in the pudding.
I think your modesty and self-deprecation has actually shone through in this chat. And you know what? Yeah. Whatever bits of luck you've had along the way, it's your own talent and, as you say, hard work and perseverance and ability to do those roles and those jobs that's enabled you to still be doing it now and, you know, be universally popular. So you can be modest about yourself, but I think it's clear for everyone else that you're very good at what you do and you know what you're doing.
Yeah, defo. Thanks, man.
That's very generous of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on, Tim. It's been absolutely
exciting
to chat. It's been brilliant. John, thank you to you as ever. Thank you to everyone at home for listening as well. You can follow us at Filthy Lipout on Twitter. Please leave your reviews, your likes and your shares as well. That's all we've got time for this week, and we will see you next time.